From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Does peace have a chance in Syria? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Syria's civil war makes for grim statistics. 125,000 dead, 1 million starving, 3 million refugees. Now peace talks are scheduled next month in Geneva. The goal is a transition government, but President al-Assad says he'll never step down. And rebel forces are so divided they're fighting among themselves. All sides are battling to gain advantage on the ground. Is that where the issues finally will be decided? We'll look at the prospects for a diplomatic solution and what's at stake for Russia, the U.S., and the rest of the Middle East. Today's talking point, can America's power grid survive renewable energy? First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Olney back with To the Point. Peace talks scheduled for Geneva next month would bring Syria's government together with rebel forces, but bloody fighting continues, and there's growing concern that the civil war will finally be decided, not at the conference table, but on the battlefield. We'll hear more about that. Today's talking point, renewable power is touted as the benign, non-polluting solution to climate change, but millions of windmills and solar panels could make it harder to keep the lights on. We'll find out why. First, this news update. This once proud and prosperous city can't pay its debts. So said Judge Stephen Rhodes in Detroit today, ruling that America's former industrial powerhouse is eligible for bankruptcy protection. Micheline Maynard is former Detroit bureau chief for the New York Times. She's now contributor to Forbes.com and editor of Curbing Cars, Rethinking How We Can Get Around. Thank you very much for being on our program.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
The judge said that bankruptcy was a foregone conclusion. He also, however, ruled on something that wasn't, and that was the fate of the pensioners in Detroit.
Right. So Michigan law actually protects pensions. But there was a loophole that Judge Rhodes here in the Detroit Federal Bankruptcy Court found, which is that in the definition of pensions in the state constitution, it said that pensions are a contractual issue. Under federal bankruptcy law, all contractual issues are up for review in a bankruptcy. So if the framers of the 1963 Constitution had written it a little bit differently, the pensioners in Detroit might see their pensions protected under state law, but because of the way it was written, Judge Rhodes couldn't protect them.
There have been complaints by pensioners that they might not be able to pay their mortgages, particularly those who are older and have been on pensions for a long time. Do we really know, though, how much cutting there's going to be of the pensions?
We don't. And in fact, I don't think any pensioner should expect to lose their pension completely. In previous bankruptcies that I've covered, and those were corporate bankruptcies, I've seen pensioners take haircuts of about between 10 and 30%. You don't lose the whole pension, but your pension will go down, and that is something that is very hard for a lot of people to face.
And those are people who are already retired, as well as those, of course, who are working now and might anticipate smaller pensions than they had thought they were going to get before.
That's right. And in fact, this won't happen without negotiations. The city can negotiate with the unions. There's 48 different unions in the city of Detroit. But generally, pensions are set according to a scale in those contracts. So the city is going to make proposals to the unions. The unions can reject them, and then it goes to the judge. And the judge could just arbitrarily approve it, but I think he's going to want to see proof of negotiations.
The unions can also appeal the decision. Do they act like they might do that?
Oh, absolutely. Sharon Levine, who's an attorney for AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Workers, came in the press room today and basically said, we're going right to the Sixth Circuit Court in Cincinnati. And then beyond that, she thinks this could end up in the Supreme Court.
So what is the sense of things in Detroit now that this is official? They have, in fact, declared bankruptcy, largest city in the country ever to do that. And you have your editor of Curbing Cars, Rethinking How We Get Around. Are they rethinking Detroit?
Yeah, there's actually starting to be talk about Detroit, what comes after the bankruptcy. And this is on a very fast track. The financial fix is expected to come over the next 11, 12 months. And so you know, they'll put Detroit through sort of this car wash of bankruptcy. What comes out the other side is being discussed. And there's a lot of concern that, you know, Detroit might get a lot of attention downtown, but the neighborhoods might not get the attention that they want. And so there's been some push and pull already about what happens to Detroit afterwards.
The guy in charge is the emergency manager, Kevin Orr. Is he likely to be elected mayor after this is all over, or is he a pretty unpopular guy?
Absolutely not. I think it would be easy to say that Kevin Orr is one of the least popular people within the city limits of Detroit. However, he's being watched very carefully by folks across the state, folks in the bankruptcy community, to see what can you actually do if you have the opportunity in Chapter 9. This is one of those cases that law students will study, that lawyers will be reviewing, and so it's fascinating to watch the history being made.
You mentioned the city limits. There's a big difference between what's going on in Detroit and the suburbs and the rest of Michigan, although the whole state is in some financial difficulty.
Right. Michigan really took it on the chin during the recession, and its unemployment rate was the highest in the country. It went up to almost 15%. And the state is coming back. There are different parts of Michigan, like Grand Rapids, the western part of the state. I live in Ann Arbor, which is a prosperous university town, way up north in Traverse City. So there's spots all over the state that are starting to see revivals or maybe never fell at all. So you definitely have a difference between Detroit itself and the outlying communities.
$18 billion in debt, 700,000 residents. That's a lot of debt for very few people.
And Judge Rhodes made that point today when he said that, you know, of course bankruptcy was a foregone conclusion. It probably should have happened years ago. And I think one of the reasons it didn't was that you had a lot of politicians who said, I can do this. I can fix Detroit. And there's a certain pride in giving it a try. But unfortunately, the problems were bigger than any single mayor could address.
Okay. We'll see how long it takes to get the financial situation together and then how long it'll take to deliver services, which are in short supply in Detroit right now as it is going bankrupt. Mickey Maynard, good to have you on our program. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Contributor to Forbes, editor of Curbing Cars, rethinking how we get around. In a moment, does peace have a chance in Syria? On To the Point.
Are you thinking about buying a new car? Consider donating your old one to KCRW and support the unique mix of news, music, and culture you love. You'll become a KCRW member and get a nice tax write-off. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warman Olney back with To the Point. The Geneva Conference that led to a nuclear deal with Iran last month also established what's being referred to as Geneva II. Scheduled for January 22nd, it would be the first meeting between the Syrian government of Bashar al-Assad and rebel forces. Martin Chuloff is Middle East correspondent for The Guardian. Good to have you on our program.
Good to be with you.
What rebel forces, I guess, is the first question that needs to be asked.
Well, absolutely. That's long been the issue. For the last 2.5 years, there's been an inability to create a coordinated, cohesive unit that speaks with one voice and aims for one purpose. As this conflict has ground on over the last 2.5 years, we've seen the rebel groups splinter into all sorts of different groups with competing agendas. Vested interests have taken stakes right across the country, and it remains to be seen whether any common political body can aim to represent the interests of the Syrian opposition.
The Syrian National Coalition is the one that is backed by the United States, as I understand it. It is referred to by some of the others as a Saudi stooge, as a Western puppet, and as traitors, because it was a group that called for military airstrikes against Syria after the chemical weapons attack.
Well, this group does maintain that from the outset, it has aimed to reorientate a nation state and move it towards a pluralistic democracy, maintaining the same borders that we see in Syria at the moment, but aiming for a different type of leadership, moving it away from totalitarian rule to something, I guess, more pluralistic and representative. So the group does insist that it certainly has goals that the West and parts of the rest of the region would certainly aspire to and relate to. It's been where it's fallen down is it's been unable to harness the myriad other opposition groups that have different reasons for wanting Assad to go. And it doesn't seem to have been a representative body on that score.
Is it, in fact, a group in exile, or does it, in fact, have people on the ground fighting in Syria?
Well, the military wing remains separate from the political wing. And again, there is not that nexus between the two bodies that you would need in order to have confidence that the civilian body can actually, have any influence over its fighters on the ground. There are some groups within the Syrian opposition on the ground that I guess would loosely answer to the political body, but not many. And there is, of course, a large and growing jihadist presence, a global jihadist presence. We're talking jihadis from around the world who have taken up camp, particularly in the north of the country, and are increasingly holding sway there and defying the Syrian opposition and doing whatever they can to, to impose their will and to establish a re-establish a caliphate in the ancient lands of Syria. And their goals have nothing to do with the original goals of the opposition, and they remain a significant problem for everybody.
So they're a problem. There are Islamist groups that don't go as far as the jihadists that you describe, but who say they're not going to go to the talks. And then there is the Syrian National Coalition, which, as I understand it, doesn't want to go unless al-Assad says that he's willing to negotiate to step down and form a transitional government, which he says he won't do.
I think there might be room to move on the latter point, not necessarily with Assad himself, but I do think there is a broader recognition right across the region that this has to stop, that the disintegration of Syria must slow down. If it doesn't, it seriously will imperil the rest of the Middle East. The suffering that's gone on there has been medieval in terms of its savagery and scale, and it shows no signs of slowing. However, there is a common interest with those who support the regime, i.e. Iran, Hezbollah, Russia, and those who loosely support elements of the opposition, i.e. parts of Western Europe and the US, in slowing this down, in bringing this to a stop, because if it doesn't, then the very geopolitics of the region will suffer in the short to medium term. So people do have a common ground in terms of getting to the table in Geneva. There is a lot of room to discuss things that have been hotly contested up until this point, whether Assad should go or even when he should go is certainly one of the things that will be first discussed. But before we get there, I guess the key regional stakeholders, Iran, Saudi Arabia, and Russia, will need to actually agree to sit in the same room to thrash things out.
So they have to sit in the same room, and some rebel group has to sit in the same room with Assad, presuming that Assad can be persuaded, as you suggest, that he might have room to move with regard to stepping down. Again, Martin Chuloff is Middle East correspondent for The Guardian. He's going to be with us for our entire program. Salman Sheikh is director of the Brookings Doha Center and a fellow at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy. Good to have you on our program.
Very good to be with you.
Thank you. What do you perceive here? Do you think that the talks will ever get off the ground?
I think this is probably the best moment in a year and a half of frustration, certainly since Iran first came up with his 6 points last spring, summer. It seems as if, as Martin said, the geopolitics of the situation, the Iranians, Russians on one side in particular, the Western powers on the other, with some regional players sort of looking on, waiting, watching. They may be now in a mood whereby which they feel that we have to get some sort of a process started. And so, yes, we will have, an opposition delegation there. How representative it is, I think it leaves a lot to be desired. But nevertheless, we will have an opposition delegation led by the official sort of SOC or ETELAS, and we will have a regime delegation there, most likely headed by the Foreign Minister, Walid Mualim.
So when you say there will be an opposition delegation, will it be the Syrian National Coalition, the one the United States has supported?
That's right. We're not likely to see Ahmed Jarbah unless there's a change, and there's still a long way to go, of course, till January the 22nd. We're likely to see some other senior members of the Syrian National Coalition, and of course the regime. But herein lies a big problem. Neither, in my view, does the regime or the opposition now represent the majority of Syrians. And you referred to the armed elements. It's not just the armed elements. It's also the elements within Syrian society who, by and large, have kept quiet, mainly to protect themselves. And they'll be watching keenly to see what happens. If the process doesn't really start to take off and the outlines of a deal don't start to show, we're likely to see that this, at least this particular conference, is not going to have much of an effect on the ground and the fighting. In fact, we may see the fighting intensify in the weeks ahead. Certainly it has over the last few weeks.
Solomon Sheikh at the Brookings Doha Center. Back to Martin Chuloff. What about the fighting now? Are all sides attempting to gain advantage between now and January 22nd?
It certainly appears that way. In a strategic corridor just to the east of the Lebanese border, Hezbollah are leading the Syrian military in trying to clear a path from, I guess, the northwestern access to Damascus, right through to Homs. It's a very strategic part of the country. There is intensive fighting there. If the regime are able to secure that area, then they have a path which effectively takes them from Damascus right through the heartland of the country up to the port of Tartus, all of which would be effectively in its control. That would be very important in terms of its strategic hold on potentially the most significant part of Syria. If you look to the north, the fighting has continued unabated for many, many months now. I guess the intimacy aspect of it is more interesting than regime versus the opposition. The jihadists that I spoke about earlier are taking an increasingly prominent role in most battles, certainly around Aleppo and Idlib and out towards Raqqa and out towards the Iraqi border. The Free Syrian Army elements do remain strong there, but they are in an invidious position in the sense that almost every operation they undertake, they need to fight with these very jihadists who they are reluctantly hosting and whom they know they will be forced into some kind of a conflict with at some point down the track.
Salman Sheikh, back to you. There has been formed a group called the Islamic Front with seven different militia groups. You've referred to that as the nail in the coffin for the Geneva talks because they don't want to have anything to do with them.
That's right. These are probably the most effective, most powerful groups. It's a combination of Salafist thought and Muslim Brotherhood thought, as you alluded to earlier, more focused on Sharia or an Islamic state, not as extreme as al-Qaeda. But it's likely that these groups are not going to come into the process just yet. There may be a chance further down the road, but they are going to be, I think, the main fighters, along with the extremists that Martin referred to, that are going to probably intensify the fighting. This is the arena, I think, where diplomacy and the politics has to have some effect in the long run. There are some of us who believe, actually, we've not got very far down this conflict. Though the Syrians themselves are exhausted, the fighting and the fighters, both the regime and these rebel fighters, are not yet exhausted. It may well be that we haven't reached a point where either side feels that it can, it is ready to draw up a surrender. And we will have a situation whereby which we're not able to get to a negotiated solution until there is a one side which is winning over the other. Certainly, that is the history of conflicts in the Levant, and whether you're talking about Lebanon or Iraq and elsewhere. And certainly, that's what the data tells us. So one side has to be clearly ahead in order to negotiate and to win a negotiated deal. Despite the talk of the regime making gains, and certainly it has been, on the battlefield, I think it's still very much ebb and flow. And yes, the strategic areas around Damascus and Homs and to the coast is the area where the regime seems to have momentum, but it's not yet decisive.
Let's focus again on geopolitics and the role particularly of the United States, first threatening to attack Syria, use military action because of the use of chemical weapons, and agreeing at the suggestion of Russia to the dismantling and destruction of the chemical arsenal. Now the U.S. is going to overtake the destruction itself, apparently at sea with a hydrolysis process. Salman Sheikh, what do you think of the American policy and actions over the past few weeks?
Well, the whole American policy has been to manage this conflict. We all know that the U.S. Externally is overstretched. It doesn't want to get involved in the quagmire that is Syria more than it has to. And domestically, of course, there's really no support for another adventure in Syria, certainly not boots on the ground, which is what people fear in the long run. So, of course, this chemical weapons issue came about, something, of course, we know that the administration knew about for many, many months before finally they and the international community acted. In one way, of course, it's positive. It's very positive that Assad seems to be cooperating with the UN and the OPCW in giving up these weapons. But for many, and especially for Syrians, it has also given him a license to continue his war against his own people. It's given him a get-out-of-jail-free card, and it's rehabilitated him because he's now become a partner for disposing of these particular weapons. And that has come about as we've seen this sort of extraordinary opening and geopolitical shift with regards to Iran in particular. And, of course, Russians seem to be the grand masters at this point in time, whereas there was a lot of criticism of Putin at the start of this conflict for sticking by Assad. Now they seem to be the go-to guys not just in regards to the chemical weapons deal, where I'm sure they've lent on Assad and so have the Iranians, but also with regards to a future political solution in Syria.
Salman Sheikh at the Brookings Doha Center. We just have a couple of minutes before we go to a break, but I want to introduce Robert Dunin, Senior Fellow for Middle East and Africa Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Good to have you on our program.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
What about it? Is Salman Sheikh correct? Has the U.S., in effect, lost the opportunity to be the go-to guy, to use Salman Sheikh's term?
Well, I'm not sure we ever were in a position or wanted to be in a position to be the go-to guy, as it were. Clearly, this administration, the Obama administration, has been deeply ambivalent about this crisis and has found a way very uniquely to disaggregate the chemical weapons issue from the general conflict in Syria, wanting to address the Syria's possession of chemical weapons and address that issue and even be willing potentially to go to use military force to address that issue, but at the same time not wanting to really touch the civil war except through this Geneva process, which frankly is hard to see that is going to lead to any kind of real resolution anytime soon. It may begin a process, as Secretary Kerry seems to want to do, with the Russians, but there are so many inherent contradictions into this process that it's hard to see how the contours of a settlement could be anywhere near.
Robert Dunin again with the Council on Foreign Relations. We'll come back with him and our other guests and add still another after we take a very brief break on our talking point later. Can America's power grid survive renewable energy? A surprising question. We'll hear some very interesting answers. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
Warren Allen back with To the Point, talking today about the civil war in Syria, the peace talks that are scheduled for Geneva on the 22nd of next month, and what the prospects are. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights has declared that war crimes have been committed by the Syrian government, including the head of state, although Bashar al-Assad is not named in here. Comments. Robert Dunin, back to you, Senior Fellow for Middle East and African Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. The U.S. appears to be dealing with al-Assad, although it has said that he should be ousted, should leave power. Is it going to have to end up swallowing the fact that he is the most powerful force on the ground, that he's able to, if he's able to succeed militarily, will we have to live with the devil we know?
Well, de facto, we have. The United States helped broker this agreement on the chemical weapons with the government of Syria, and the deal itself requires, in effect, that there is a central government in Syria that helps facilitate it, and that is the government headed by Bashar al-Assad. Moreover, as Salman Sheikh mentioned, they're sending the foreign minister, Walid Mualim, very much a loyalist to Bashar al-Assad, to the conference. And as long as the situation on the ground is as it is, Bashar al-Assad's negotiating position is stronger. This is the key to the military's opposition to their participation in the conference right now. The opposition doesn't want to participate in a conference that reflects a diminishing situation on the ground where the government is on the ascendancy. They want to have some battlefield wins. They'd like assistance from the West. And they want a conference only after the balance of power on the ground is different. But the West, and particularly the United States, is reluctant at best to provide assistance. Some of the local parties in the region, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, others have been assisting the opposition. And I think the question is whether or not those regional powers or forces are going to now up the ante, especially in light of the nuclear deal and their opposition to it that the United States and Iran have brokered. So we could actually see an intensification of fighting on the ground rather than a diminution as this conference gets near.
And we could see the forces of the government succeeding, do you think? Are they likely to, or is the situation more fluid than that, as our other guests have suggested?
Well, it is extremely fluid on the ground. What we see is that the momentum over the last number of months has been with the government. And as Salman mentioned, some of the strategic areas around Damascus have been retaken by the government and bolstered by the fact that politically they're backed by Iran and Russia. Militarily, they are helped by Hezbollah on the ground. And the opposition, in contrast, is largely fragmented. Its supply lines are limited. It is divided amongst itself. And increasingly, as Martin mentioned very early on, you have this now growing insurgency by jihadists who are flocking to Syria, who are very much putting the populace of Syria in a no-win situation, in which they are either looking to a government that has been repressive and brutal, or a possible Islamist takeover that they don't welcome either. So increasingly, the situation is becoming more fragmented rather than more unified or greater alliances being formed.
Robert Dineen again with the Council on Foreign Relations. Joshua Keating is with us, staff writer at Slate. He writes the World blog. He's a former associate editor at Foreign Policy magazine. Joshua Keating, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about Iran in this whole complex equation, and what about the nuclear deal? Does that change Iran's status in some way, and does it have a greater impetus, do you think, now than it did before to try to get Assad to make peace with the rebels?
Well, I mean, I think that, first of all, Syria loudly welcomed the nuclear deal, and the two countries just concluded a round of talks of their own. Iran obviously has been a major supporter of the Assad regime and a major financial supporter, even at a time when it's been under sanctions itself and the country's economy has been in trouble. So the optimistic take on this is that now that a kind of precedent has been set for Iran to sort of cooperate with the West when the lifting of sanctions is sort of the carrot being offered, that formula can be now applied to Syria, that Iran might be able to play a somewhat more productive role. The pessimistic way of looking at it was that the United States and other Western powers have kind of prioritized both in Syria and on Iran the removal of nuclear weapons and weapons of mass destruction from the region over human rights and the actual conventional weapons situation on the ground.
When you say that Iran might have a presence that might want to be more productive, would that involve, do you think, the withdrawal of the Hezbollah forces, which have been bolstered by Iran and apparently been extraordinarily important to Assad's ability to maintain military advantage?
Well, I think it's extremely unlikely that we'll see a break between Iran and the Syrian regime, which it sees as its as a sort of major lever for influence in that part of the Middle East. But you know, they have indicated they want to participate in the talks. Foreign Minister Zarif said that he was that the Iranian government would like to come to Geneva for the talks, but both the U.S. and the Syrian rebel groups have opposed Iranian involvement because of that. So we're unlikely to break the two sides apart. But you know, if we get into a point where we're starting to negotiate between the two sides, Iranian influence could be extremely important in sort of reaching some kind of accommodation.
What do you think about the prospect for the talks? Is there any chance, really, even though, as Salman Sheikh suggested, January 22nd is a long way off?
It is a long way off, and I think, you know, one hopeful precedent of the Iran talks was that was probably a more conclusive deal than anyone was expecting a few months earlier. But right now, there's not a lot of reason for optimism. And even the Syrian National Coalition, which has finally agreed to participate in the talks, is saying that that any agreement has to see Assad's removal from power, and that's not even getting into the question of the rebel groups on the ground who don't even want to participate until he steps down. And meanwhile, you have President Assad who's talking about running for election next year and planning his 2014 campaign, and is clearly in no mood to go anywhere. So until that fundamental issue of whether Assad's going to stay or not is resolved, I don't see a lot of room for accommodation.
Salman Sheikh, back to you, the Brookings Doha Center. You said earlier that very crucial to all of this are all the Syrians who aren't necessarily armed and who are fearful of taking either one side or the other, if it can be boiled down to one as opposed to another. What about the election and the possibility that Assad is, again, as we just heard, apparently planning a campaign, getting ready to execute it? Would he be, in fact, reelected?
Well, any election under these conditions is likely to be a big, big sham.
Sure.
I mean, sure, he'll get reelected. They've even, from what I understand from folks in Damascus, even calculated he'll probably win about 75% of the vote of those who can vote. And, of course, those will be in the sort of heartlands where the government has control. It certainly won't be the refugees, the millions of refugees outside, or those displaced elsewhere in the country. But, you know, there is as I said, there is a third way here between this regime and more extremist Islamists. And that third way is very much a Syrian solution, where there is a dialogue that takes place that involves a much broader a group of people than just the regime in opposition, which is Geneva, at least right now. One hopes that if there is any process, that process brings those Syrians in. We are speaking to Syrians of all different backgrounds who have indicated a willingness to take part. These are people who are real social souls and influencers within their society, but who, as I said, are too scared to enter into the fray right now. The viability of any diplomatic process in Geneva or elsewhere will depend on getting those Syrians involved, because you can't have a foreign-imposed solution on any civil war, and certainly not in the Middle East. At the end of the day, you need to have a legitimacy that comes from a process, and that's why, of course, we need that. Look, I think there is a belief out there in the diplomatic arena that a deal can be cut, that the Iranians somehow will at least consider Assad, they will never let go of him. This is a thick red line. But at the same time, consider pushing him in terms of some sort of a transitional government that has some power, which includes the opposition. I think that is what people are working towards. Whether it will really survive and have an impact on the ground. Of course, I'm skeptical. We only have to look at the numerous agreements that were forged around the Lebanese civil war, which lasted 15 years, to understand that this may be part of a very long diplomatic process. And, of course, all this time, we're going to have tens of thousands of people killed. And one other thing I'd just say is that, yes, there's a lot of talk about regional countries being able to turn off the opposition fighters. Well, I believe, and given talking to some of these, in fact, this conflict is now taking on a life of its own. I'm not sure whether we can just turn off this conflict. And we see that, we witnessed that with this new Islamist coalition, which has just formed itself over the last month or so.
Martin Shulov, let me go back to you, our Middle East correspondent for The Guardian. Do you see any effort to broaden the conversation at Geneva II, as suggested by Salman Sheikh? Is there a way of getting influential people in Iran who haven't taken sides, who are fearful of signing up one way or the other, and somehow working something out? Or are we looking at decades of civil war?
I think Salman's spot on in the sense that there are large numbers of Syrians who have never been loyal to the regime, but have been given no reason whatsoever to throw their support behind the opposition. We speak to these people consistently in Damascus and in Lebanon, where they come to seek refuge from time to time, how the tables have turned there. And they say to themselves that, look, we need to take a stake. We want to take a stake, but there is no capacity to harness what we have to offer. And there very definitely is a large group of people there who would like to play a role in reorientating the nation state of Syria, more or less keeping it to within the borders that it has now, and to, I guess, moving it towards a pluralistic democracy over time. But there doesn't seem to be any sort of capacity to bring these people into the discussion. One point I'd like to make in terms of Iran is Iran's interests lie solely in keeping Damascus as a strategic bridgehead for Hezbollah, which is the most important arm of their foreign policy. The leverage that Hezbollah has over the Israelis is extremely important to the Iranian regime. And to that end, they are not rusted on to Bashar al-Assad, the man, but they would be very interested in the systems and structures of the Syrian regime remaining in place, which allow Hezbollah to have that strategic depth back into Damascus, and that link straight through Baghdad into Qom and into Tehran. So they will be looking to play a prominent role in a discussion. It does seem to me that the nuclear deal, the chemical weapons deal, which was brokered by the Russians, allowed everybody to step back. Everybody looked down their barrels at that time and blinked. Iran certainly took that opportunity to step forward and say, well, you know, let's move forward on the nuclear deal. And to that end, I do think they would be interested in the grand bargain on Syria, and they do want to use the leverage or the legitimacy that they got from that nuclear deal as leverage over some kind of a process rather than a conclusion that will probably start in Geneva next month.
Joshua Keating, back to you. What about Saudi Arabia scathing in its attacks on the United, or not attacks, but in its criticism and feelings about the United States and, of course, about Iran as well? Is it likely to be a party at Geneva as well?
Well, I think that, over a number of issues, we've seen Saudi Arabia kind of breaking with U.S. foreign policy to a greater extent than it has before, both over Iran and Syria, where they would like to see the U.S. play a more active role. I mean, I think that was probably part of what motivated their rather odd decision last month, where they, were elected to and then chose not to take a rotating seat on the U.N. Security Council. The question is, how long will that last, and how much leverage does Saudi Arabia really have over U.S. foreign policy? And that's probably diminishing a bit with the lessening U.S. dependence on Saudi oil. I'm not sure that they quite have the levers to influence U.S. policy as much as they once did.
Robert Dineen, back to you. What about Saudi Arabia? And do you think that they're losing their ability to influence what it is that the United States does? How might that affect the proceedings in Geneva?
Well, I think at this point the Saudis are reassessing their whole approach. They've made quite a public appearance about, you know, renouncing what they had lobbied for, which was a Security Council seat. They've made it clear that they're not happy about the Iran negotiations between the United States and Iran. But I think at this point, they've extinguished the limits of their, or exhausted the limits of their influence by going down this route, and now are have to be thinking about other ways. But I think one of them will be to be more independent when it comes to Syria. They clearly have not been happy with the United States' unwillingness to arm the opposition and to be take a somewhat hands-off approach. I don't see any signs that the Saudis are therefore going to desist from arming the rebels, but the question is whether they have the resources, they have the money, but do they have the access to the kind of weaponry that the jihadists, or rather the opposition, seeks, and whether or not there are enough oppositionists left who willing to fight, because they're clearly starting to lose their inspiration as they see their situation worsening.
We are out of time. I want to thank you all very much for being on this program. Once again, the talks are scheduled to take place on January 22nd in Geneva, and there are many questions that have yet to be answered. Robert Dineen at the Council on Foreign Relations, Joshua Keating at Slate, writes the World blog, Salman Sheikh at the Brookings Doha Center, a fellow at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy, Martin Chuloff, Middle East correspondent for The Guardian. Thank you all very much for being on our program today. As the development of renewable power sources increases by leaps and bounds, is America prepared for new energy from millions of windmills and solar panels? We'll hear about the possible impact on the nation's fragile power grid in a moment on To the Point.
Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW.
Warren Olney back with today's Talking Point. In Golden, Colorado, the Department of Energy has just turned on a supercomputer the size of a Mack truck called Peregrine. It does a quadrillion calculations per second. Don't even think about what that might mean. Its job is to figure out how to cope with a risk from something the public thinks is benign, and that is renewable energy. That's from a story by Evan Halper in today's Los Angeles Times. Evan Halper, good to have you on our program.
It's good to be here, Warren.
So what is a Peregrine with its quadrillion calculations per second coming up with?
Well, they're trying to come up with all the right formulas and algorithms and all kinds of other stuff that's so complicated it could make your head work to be able to integrate all this renewable energy that's coming online with a grid that's still based on technology of 100 years ago.
Okay, let's take that apart here. First of all, the grid itself, based on technology of 100 years ago, this is the grid that sends power back and forth from major cities to major cities.
That's right. And it was based on power being generated by coal or maybe even natural gas, a steady power supply that's not intermittent like renewable energy is. So with renewable energy, you never know if the sun is going to stop shining or the wind is going to stop blowing. And it creates all kinds of complications because it's not a stable, constant energy source. And the grid needs that to be able to keep running smoothly.
So does the computer then, Peregrine, have to take into consideration all these millions of solar panels and windmills that might be built and try to figure out when and each one of them might be contributing power to the grid and what the consequences might be?
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's a very complicated balancing act. And so they need to prepare for all kinds of variables. So if the wind does stop blowing in one place but the sun is shining strong somewhere else, the grid's ready for that. And right now it's having trouble keeping up with those kinds of rapid fluctuations. That's not to say this can't be done. This is something that when you talk to people at the Renewable Energy Laboratory, you talk to the people at Caltech who've been working on it, they're confident that it can happen, but it just takes all kinds of changes, and it's a massive undertaking. A study a group of scholars did at Caltech, they said this will be one of the greatest challenges industrialized societies have ever faced.
Do we need essentially a new grid?
Well, there's all kinds of ways to go about it. I mean, you could have what they call microgrids. You could have where instead of everything being as centralized as it is now, the military is experimenting with this. There's small grids that just cover that are self-sustaining and cover small areas. But the grid 20 years from now is going to be very different than the grid of today. At least if the state of California and other states continue to pursue these aggressive green energy goals.
You say this is described as the essential challenge for industrial society. Are we a little late in thinking about it?
Well, some people would say yes. You know, it depends who you talk to. The utilities who are concerned about this, and they've been reluctant and to go along as quickly as some of the policymakers have been trying to push them, and certainly as quickly as green energy activists are trying to push them, say, look, we're not prepared for this. We need to slow things down. But others say, look, it's in the utility's interest to slow things down and cry Chicken Little here because they have a business model that works for them. And when you start making these changes and you start with the microgrids and you start allowing more rooftop solar and people putting energy back into the grid from their own homes and the utilities having to give them a discount when they do that, it obviously cuts into the profits of those utility companies. So there's 1,000 different opinions on whether we waited too long, how prepared we are, whether we can meet these mandates. So it's a tough question to answer.
Are there problems already in places where people do have, solar on the roof, and so they are, and certain companies are now powered by solar, and they put their energy into the grid? Has that caused problems anyplace?
Well, yeah, it has in other states, and the folks who run the grid in California say they're close to that happening here, and there have been some reports that say stability issues could come up very soon. Those reports are countered by other reports that say, no, that's not really the case. Stability is not so much of a concern. We're on track to do what needs to be done. But, yeah, there have been places where the story notes wind producers, for example, have been paid to produce wind that isn't getting used. It's something that definitely is balancing out the renewable energy when it's available, when it's needed, is a really tough thing. And of course, the secret sauce in all this that everyone's trying to find the recipe for would be storing renewable energy. And so a lot of investment right now is going into storage. So if you produce solar energy at a time that's far from peak demand, but the sun is shining strong, is there a way to put that into some kind of giant battery or some other storage device, hang on to the power, and then use it when everyone comes home from work and turns on their power and needs all this electricity? The Public Utilities Commission in California, for example, has just mandated that the utility companies put major investment into that type of storage.
We have listeners around the country. Are they watching other states and regions in the country, watching California to see what happens here, or are they trying to catch up?
Like many things with energy over the last several years, California has taken the lead. It's taken the lead because it has some of the most aggressive renewable energy mandates, and so it's confronting these issues sooner than other places are. It's not just, I understand you've got listeners all over the country, but in terms of California's work on this, it is indeed being watched nationally.
Are companies backing away from the development of renewable energy in other places as the whole problem with the grid begins to become more and more known about?
When you say, are they backing away from development of renewable energy in other places, you mean in other states?
Yes.
Well, I'm not aware at this point that the grid has created a disincentive for renewable energy projects to go forward. But what it's a bit more subtle than that. It may be something that policymakers look at and say, okay, can we create the kind of mandate California has where they want 33% of power to be coming from renewable sources very soon? And some politicians could look at that and say, well, the grid's not ready for that, so we'll slow down. And when you don't have those kinds of mandates, it slows down production of renewable energy.
What would it mean to sort of readjust the grid, as you're suggesting, or build a new grid? Are we talking about big power lines going from state to state that we don't have now?
Sure, you're talking transmission lines, but you also could be talking about the kind of microgrids I mentioned earlier. you really have to reshape the whole system. You've got to change the way the markets work, which is extraordinarily complex undertaking, and some public utility commissions are looking at that, and the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission is also looking at it. So there's infrastructure that needs to be involved, but there's also just dealing with the way the energy markets work and restructuring them. And one of the reports that I cited in the story mentioned that it's going to be the investment is going to be something in the realm of, I think, $1 trillion over the next, I believe it was 20 years. And, you know, if you talk to experts about that, that is a huge amount of money. That's a national figure. But on the other hand, the grid needs constant maintenance and constant upkeep. And spending on that order of magnitude might happen anyway, even if we were continuing along the fossil fuel path. But the trick is spending that $1 trillion the right way so that all these new energy sources can be integrated properly.
That sounds like a problem that Peregrine is well-designed to deal with. I don't know how else you could do this except to do quadrillion calculations every second in order to figure out how complex the situation is. Evan Halpert, it's always good to talk with you, and thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thank you, Warren.
Evan's story on this issue appears in today's Los Angeles Times. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast at a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.